Hi, I'm Lindsay. I'm a registered veterinary nurse and I qualified in 2009. And I'm now a teaching fellow at the Clinical Skills Centre at the Royal Veterinary College.
And I'm Sarah. I'm also a registered veterinary nurse. I graduated in 2011 and I'm now an assistant lecturer in the veterinary nursing here at the Royal Veterinary College. Welcome to our podcast.
So we're here today with Brian, our podcast engineer, to investigate the evidence base behind the nursing practices that we use every day.
We want to make this evidence more accessible to you in practice.
This is VN's Investigate.
Alison qualified as a veterinary nurse whilst working in a small practice in Hertfordshire. In 2001, she joined the Queen Mother Hospital at the Royal Veterinary College as a general surgery nurse, working in all areas of the hospital. In 2005, she became a senior theatre nurse and sat her diploma in advanced veterinary nursing, the surgical stream, gaining the highest marks for that year.
In 2007, she became head theatre nurse, and in 2012 became the first nurse in the UK to study for and pass the surgical veterinary technician specialist qualification in the USA. Alison has co-written the theatre chapters in the BSAVA Textbook of Veterinary Nursing and in the BSAVA Manual of Canine and Feline Advanced Veterinary Nursing. She has written articles for the VNJ and the Veterinary Nurse and spoken at many veterinary conferences worldwide.
On a daily basis, Alison managed 7 operating theatres and a team of specialised theatre nurses in a multidisciplinary hospital. She enjoys all aspects of hands-on theatre nursing and in particular the cardiothoracic patients undergoing open heart surgery. In 2019, Alison took on the role of cardiothoracic surgery service coordinator, working in the operating room and in intensive care with heart surgery patients.
So, welcome, Ali. It's a pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, now I've worked with you for many years and you've definitely been a positive guiding influence on my nursing career. But what I'd like to know is, when you were younger, what did you want to be? And did you ever envisage that you'd be where you are now?
So, I always thought I knew that I wanted to be a veterinary nurse. At school, you know, you look in the little careers booklet, and I always remember that it said that there was a very brief paragraph on veterinary nursing, which kind of culminated in the you earn between £5,000 and £7,000 a year. At school, it wasn't really thought of as the career that I should be heading for, and I was kind of pushed into looking at veterinary medicine as always, and potentially other animal related degrees, but it wasn't really what I wanted to do. But sort of as they are the guidance that you kind of follow their influence a little bit, and so looked into all of those. I did sit A levels, but kind of again still really wasn't sure that that's what I wanted, and decided then after the year after my A levels to sort of take some time out, earn some money and do some travelling. Up until that point, I'd always been helping out in a veterinary practice and weekends and school holidays, that sort of thing, and they offered me at that point the opportunity. So I knew when I got back from traveling that I had the opportunity to study veterinary nursing, to do the day release at college and work in the practice the rest of the time, which kind of was what I always wanted to do anyway, and so it came around full loop actually back to what I wanted. So actually now, sort of looking back, knowing what you really want, and then I guess then how far in veterinary nursing you can go if you want to now as well. I guess all those years ago it wasn't so open to everybody, but now there's so many different routes into nursing and so many opportunities once you are a nurse that actually should definitely go for it if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think you've definitely, because I've obviously known you for a while, but you know, you've experienced many different aspects of veterinary nursing, and there's definitely, like you say, more opportunities now. But it's not a sort of straight path. So you do that loop to finally get back to know what you actually want to do, and that must be quite nice to have that unique perspective on the profession.
Yeah, and I think sort of going from the wanting to do it and that's all I ever wanted to do really, now coming full circle to sort of writing the book chapters about the subject that I really do enjoy the most, makes it to me that actually that's even more rewarding, because now I would love to rewrite that paragraph in the careers booklet about what a veterinary nurse could do. Because, you know, it would be very different, and it's actually a really fulfilling career, and should be encouraged.
I definitely agree.
So much change, hasn't there? And just, I guess, even in the time that you've been qualified, but just overall in the nursing profession, so much change and so many opportunities. And I guess that's what we're talking about today, is how do you bring about these changes, and how can you make these big changes and then these smaller changes in your practice as well? So I guess starting right at the beginning, can you just tell us a bit about a change that you've made in your own practice?
Yeah, absolutely. Here at the hospital, when I started working in theatre full time, so instead of rotating around all the areas, specialised in one area, and sort of started to look at some of the protocols and practices that were in place, as you would do, just to sort of see the whys and the wherefores, really. Also, at a not too dissimilar time, I was asked to speak at the Veterinary Soft Tissue Surgeons Association meeting about managing theatres and how potentially managing a theatre can help reduce your complication rate. And so I really started looking at all of the different options and all of the different sort of protocols that we had in place and are in place generally in practice, to see sort of what was there, what was in our human healthcare counterparts, what they were doing, what information was out there, just taking an overall look, really, because I sort of feel that lots of things that are done in practice are just handed down almost generation to generation, and sort of when you start delving down in asking sort of, well, why are we doing that, it's because my head nurse taught me, and how did they know? Well, it's because their head nurse taught them. So I think there's lots of historic stuff that we were doing that actually nobody had an idea or any evidence to suggest that it was the right way. We also didn't have any evidence to suggest potentially it was the wrong way. So I don't want to think that actually you have to change for change's sake, but definitely looking at some of our protocols and practices and researching that further led me to down a path of looking at some of our protocols. And I guess the biggest ones at that time, and there I kind of all linked, would be aseptic hand preparation for surgery, and then patient preparation for surgery as well. And those are the two sort of main areas that I looked at, as well as safety in theatre.
I think that's really, you've made a really important point there in the beginning about the change in the way that people think, in not just taking someone's word for it and things that have been handed down. And although that is very useful, we also need to look at the evidence. And I just wonder if there was if that came from within, or whether you were prompted in any way, because I think you probably were among the first to sort of look at things in an evidence-based way in that environment, certainly for the nurses. So do you think it was something that you just did, or was it because you were being involved in these conferences and writing chapters and things like that?
Yeah, I think actually there were a few nurses around in different both referral and primary care practices that all had an interest in sort of looking and knowing. And we kind of, for various different either conferences or group meetings or communication, would be get together and would talk about things and how, what we'd like to see, and what, and you know, people have got experience from all different parts of their own lives and work careers. And you know, it was the sorts of things we were talking about, sort of, have you seen this, have you seen that. There was obviously quite a lot brought about by different campaigns, so within the NHS and with in the US, with they had a Safer Lives campaign as well around about that sort of time, which all spoke about hand preparation and even just the general WHO guidelines for effective hand hygiene. All of these things were just really starting to come out as more day-to-day topics in sort of on the news and within human hospitals. And you know, you sort of take all that information in and sort of start looking at actually, well, what are we doing, and why are we doing what we're doing, and it sort of went from there, really.
Okay, so there's sort of three kind of, you're right, they are all linked, aren't they? But there's three kind of major changes: the aseptic hand preparation, the safety checklist, and the patient preparation that you were able to make a change in practice. Was there any one that was, I don't know, like one that sort of sticks with you a bit more, one maybe the first one or something that got the ball rolling, or was it all kind of just together, you know, all happened at the same time?
It happened all very similar times, just because I really think that sort of that lecture that I had to write really pushed me into sort of looking and gathering evidence and speaking to different people and getting information together. And then it's a bit like, I don't know, once you start one thing, you go, well, I do definitely go off on tangents quite easily of sort of like, oh, well, that means that this might, we might need to look at this and we might need to look at this as well. And actually sometimes change, as you know, is quite a scary thing for some people. But actually sometimes if we're going to change everything in one go and it becomes like a whole new process, that sometimes it kind of works both ways. Sometimes small changes are really good to build up to something, and sometimes actually if we're saying that actually I guess hand preparation was probably the first one that I started looking at most closely, and I guess when we started with that and people started to see, look at evidence, like investigate, see papers that have been written and products comparisons, that sort of thing, it automatically makes you look at other things. So the patient preparation, for example, which makes that much easier to provoke thought and change with, I suppose.
And it's so challenging, isn't it? Because all these things that you're talking about takes time. Like even just the thinking about, okay, what am I doing and why am I doing it? Because we're so automatically on autopilot so much of the time in practice. And I think particularly at the moment with sort of the challenges with staffing and too many patients and all that sort of thing, like it makes it even harder. But sort of even in these changes that you're talking about, I know they were small changes that then led to a big change, but it's so, so important, isn't it? And it's still such an important part of our job that we have to make the time to look at these things and to challenge ourselves. And it's probably the times where we're the busiest that those things fall, but actually are probably the most needed almost.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, COVID-19 has completely taught us again, and probably the world in much, much wider, about effective hand hygiene, how important that is. And so, you know, that actually makes it a bit easier in some ways, doesn't it? Because people are up for like doing their best. I agree completely, yeah, making that time. But if you get the involvement of people and you get the buy-in, I was really, really conscious before any changes came in that actually it was right, and it was everything could, that any question that could have been thought of or come back on was already answered before it was a question, if that makes sense. So, you know, we didn't get to the, well, let's just give this a go, see what happens, and then keep changing things constantly. Very much I'm lucky that working in a university environment, sort of challenging the evidence and looking at evidence and doing the best that you can for your patients is something that everybody on every level is encouraged to do on a daily basis. So I can completely understand that working in a team that isn't so supportive and so open to positive changes for the best for the patients would be really, really difficult. And I'm sure that many, many people experience that on a daily basis, sort of, if it's not broken, why are we changing it? But that's a difficult one.
So let's start at the beginning. If we use the aseptic hand preparation, can you just tell us about the beginning and what you did, and then what were your next steps in with that change?
Yeah, so I guess first of all, I did lots of reviewing of articles that had been written, product comparisons that had been done. I kind of, again, I have got a great network of people working in lots of other areas, in other hospitals, in practice, sort of finding out what they were all doing, what products they were using, you know, because we're all there to help and support each other, really. It's not a secret that can't be shared. So I did lots of sort of finding out options that people were using. When I started reading up, I mean, using sort of some of the probably most basic, you don't have to have access to every library possible, but even using things like the World Health Organization website, that sort of thing, they have loads of data and information on there that's all freely accessible, that very much spoke about using alcohol hand preparations as a preferred method of aseptic hand prep. I guess they're working in a lot of countries where water supply and product supply is fairly challenging, and so using an alcohol prep for them had sort of many levels. But definitely when you then start looking at product comparisons using alcohol-based products versus some of the more routine or historically chosen products, there was definitely evidence out there to suggest that maybe they had some benefits for what we wanted to use them for. I did speak to lots of reps for some of the alcohol-based products that were available. I do sometimes know that I'm probably a salesman's dream in that, you know, what they tell me, I was like, yeah, that sounds great, But actually, I'm presented with the papers that very much support the product that they're trying to sell you, as opposed to making sure it is a non-biased review. And that's quite difficult. But actually, some of the papers and that they were sharing, it was so so well shown that an alcohol hand preparation had so many benefits that actually it was actually quite difficult to find fault with it.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think it's one of those things, we're so scared of making mistakes in practice, or so scared of, you know, being duped at some point and then making the wrong decision, because, you know, day to day we are, like, we do have patients' lives at stake, and also like those around us as well, with all the sort of health and safety side of things. But like in these situations, it is a learning curve, and you will look back one day and go, oh god, I just took that completely for granted, what that salesperson said, whereas now I definitely question this and this, or have a look a bit more at, you know, sort of non-biased data and things like that. But we've got to sort of not be afraid of going on that learning curve and realizing that actually when we look back, we could have done better potentially. But that's all about like this, you know, lifelong learning and keeping progressing. And if we work in teams, then we can watch out for each other and go, oh, have you thought about this or that? And yeah, I think it's embracing the uncertainty sometimes, and embracing that you may do something differently next time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always do anything that I change, whether it's changing a shift in a rotor or changing a product, is have it as a review session. So, you know, have it, this is what we're going to do now, this is the reason behind it, this is the protocol from now on. But you know what, in 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, whatever the time frame will be, we'll all get back together and look at it all again and sort of see, has it worked, where hasn't it worked? And you know, it doesn't have to be set in stone, it can definitely, and it will always continue to evolve.
And I think it's important what you said about drawing on all those resources. So this for you as that person that was leading the change had to make sure that the change was workable and something that was logistic and doable for the team. So, you know, if you saw an area where you could improve, it's not going to work if you can't get the product, or the product's not available in this country, or, you know, it's too expensive. Or so drawing on all the resources, not just the papers that say this, you know, this could be better, but thinking about that in context of your team and of your environment, and then what's available, and bringing in the rep to get, you know, to get their opinion. And it's drawing on all of those things and having that overview, which I think is part of it. And it's not always down to the science or the evidence. It's about looking at things in a holistic way and what works for that team.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, if it means that you've got to walk from one end of the hospital to another to do each individual task, then it's physically not going to work, is it? No, I agree completely. There's many twists, isn't there? The financial constraints, the storage concerns, you know, lots and lots of different things.
And like you say, people don't, some, well, not everyone, but a lot of people don't like change. You know, it's another thing they've got to sort of think about in their day, and they've got lots of things to do. So in your leadership role, how did you engage or influence or motivate your team to engage with that change and start on the review process?
Yeah, I think we all think that people don't like change, but I think often that's sometimes a preconceived idea of our own as opposed to actually what's truthful. There are certain people I'm sure that, yeah, change is a bit scary, but I always make sure I involve everybody. I don't make sort of unilateral decisions that will affect everybody else, but nobody has a clue what's going to happen or the reasons why. I think a lot of the time, and this is my biggest thing for nursing, is that for everything, knowing why you're doing something has to be the most important part. So, you know, giving from a nursing to fellow nursing colleagues, having the rep that we used for the hand preparation actually was a human registered nurse and had been for many, many years. So that was so much easier because actually she knew what were the problems or the concerns or the issues or the potential pitfalls that we would maybe see. So she was able to speak directly to the teams rather than it coming from me and, you know, hearing it from an independent person. Often that works quite nicely. They people feel that they're listened to and that the questions that they have can be answered directly. So always engaging with all of our team as well, making sure that, you know, any concerns that they had were listened to, we worked out how that would or wouldn't be a problem or a benefit, and sort of making sure we listened to everybody. I also made sure I worked for all of these projects sort of with the head of the surgery service, because actually so for them to take that back to their teams and their sort of the not peer pressure, but, you know, rather than it being, oh, she's changed this again and this is now what we've got to do, you know, taking it back and to, for them to hear from one of their peers that actually I've been involved with this from the beginning, I've looked at all the evidence, there is evidence to show that this is a preferable way, I think this is what we should be doing as a vet school teaching veterinary nursing students and veterinary surgeons of the future, that actually this is a positive thing for our patients as well, you know, taking all that multi-pronged approach again so that it was sort of buy-in from everybody to show them actually it wasn't going to make a huge difference to their daily routine and actually was better all round.
And the more people you get involved and get motivated, then the easier it will be, presumably, because it sort of the change spreads.
Yeah. And then once people start seeing the benefits, so I guess alcohol, like how many years people were scrubbing their hands with detergent based products and scrubbing brushes, actually had extremely sore hands, extremely sore skin, which then is a really negative cycle about that they don't want to wash their hands because actually it hurts. And therefore, from an infection control point of view, is not ideal. Actually, a few times or a week or so, we did all of the pre stuff. So everybody got given product to sort of prepare their hands for using alcohol, to get the hand health back to how it should be, ready to start using the alcohol-based product. And then once we did that, and everyone felt, actually, this makes my hands so much softer, and actually it's not cracking anymore, and it makes my hands much more comfortable for me, which means I'm more likely to do this in between patients because it's not stinging every time I wash my hands, you know, like it just sort of snowballs, doesn't it? But sometimes people need to experience that themselves.
So I guess there's different levels of benefit for different people. So you've got your team where it's going to potentially benefit them from a hand health point of view or from a time point of view, and then you've got your management team who obviously are not scrubbing in, but maybe it benefits them from a cost point of view. yeah, you and see the different arms of
yeah,
benefit.
Totally. Yeah, and I did, obviously I did a like a financial comparison to what we were doing now versus what we proposed to do, from cost, from product, from any changes that we needed to make around the hospital in order to have that product available, what products then we could get rid of if we didn't need to have them in such volume anymore. Absolutely take everything in storage requirements. Obviously an alcohol-based product requires different storage to a detergent-based product. Lots of different things, but actually making sure that everybody's little buy-in was met, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And it's really interesting hearing you talk about this, because obviously you are a leader in the hospital and you're the sort of, you're in charge of the area when you're making the changes, but all the things that you're talking about, you don't have to be in charge to be able to explore these options and have a look at these things and go, okay, actually I can look at the costings and I can look at buy-in from everyone and I can talk to everyone. Like, you don't have to be in a position of leadership in order to lead on change, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You just have to have an interest and a want or a desire to make sure the process that you're looking at is done to the best. And actually, often that comes much, much better from people that are just super interested in that area. And now not everyone is going to be interested in aseptic hand technique. It may well be something completely different from a more patient-based change. But actually, if you've got, it's almost, to me, it's better for somebody that's got that investment in it, as opposed to it being made from a financial decision or a management type decision.
Yeah, definitely. I think, and we were talking about this with Rachel, it's all about that diversity. Rachel in a previous podcast, it's all about that diversity in ideas and having everyone play to their strengths and say, okay, this is what I'm super interested in, and so that I'm gonna, you know, make this the best I possibly can, and then someone else will be looking at something else because that's where their interests lie, and sort of having diversity in opinions and approaches and all these sorts of things that really strengthens the team as a whole.
Yeah, and then I think if people have got their project and they get support from their other team, I kind of imagine as well that they would therefore give more support to other project managers of other projects around the hospital, around the practice, because they've been on that receiving end. They know what it's like when they need the help or the support of somebody else. So I think it just fosters good relationships. It gets people to know people in other areas of the practice or the hospital that they may not see or come in contact with on a daily basis.
Not to mention the benefits for your CV and like, yeah, for your, yeah, own career interest and that sort of thing as well.
If you are in a leadership or managerial position, then I know that we've always been encouraged to do things that are of our own interest and explore development and areas that we want to explore. But again, it comes down to the time thing. So I wonder if you've got any tips for employers that maybe aren't doing this at the moment, but want their team to explore these issues or anything that they can change or their own personal development. Or maybe just to allow them to do it, I don't know, just in an appraisal discover what it is that they actually are interested in and know what that is. And
yeah, and absolutely, I guess, yeah, sort of small mini projects that hopefully don't, I mean, some of these projects are pretty large on a large scale, especially in a hospital, but some things that can definitely be looked at and have as mini projects that people, again, I think if people are interested in it, they also somehow find some time, don't they?
Yeah, that's true.
Yes, everyone is super busy. And I know at the moment, there are absolute challenges and patient care is always everybody's number one priority, as it should be. But I guess ultimately, a lot of the things that we've spoken about so far are still patient care. It's not the hands-on physically giving a medication or a treatment, but actually if we encourage people to have really good hand hygiene from an infection control point of view, reducing potential transmission between patients or reducing potential nosocomial infections for patients within a hospital setting is also a benefit, obviously, to the patient and to the owner, but actually also financially to the practice too.
So outlining that benefit as well is a good idea.
Yeah.
I was just wondering, so you talked about a review process that happened. So I was just wondering what that looks like when you're doing it with the aseptic hand preparation and what happened after the review.
So I would always encourage everybody to speak up on a more regular basis rather than wait till, you know, a scheduled review session if they felt that there were any concerns. But it was also nice to get some positive feedback as well as we went along, to sort of how different people found it, but actually how you know, their perceived worries about change weren't actually a problem. We had regular sort of in-house training sessions, as well as after certain periods of time, sort of from a review point of view. I got initially the rep to do a lot of training with everybody across the hospital, so that actually we made sure it happened. So they did some great stuff using UV light boxes and generally how to wash your hands, which again nowadays is very much sort of in the public eye, and it's even if you go into a bathroom in a restaurant, there's quite often a WHO hand wash guide on the wall now, where again this is, I don't know what, 10 plus years ago, where it wasn't quite so out there. So I had the reps come in and do some hand hygiene practical sessions with everybody, so that they knew how to use the product properly. We put those boxes into our clinical skills centre as well, to make sure that when the students were being taught that they had all of those resources available. We did that initially, and then after I mean, I can't actually remember how many months it was, but when we sort of look back on it to review it, we looked back at, you know, where all the products were situated. Did we need more products to be placed in areas that we hadn't maybe thought of at the beginning? We looked at consumption, so actually how much we were using, and so from a cost perspective, how that was being absorbed within fees within the hospital, for example. We looked sort of, I guess it's a little bit anecdotal, but looked at time. You know, surgeons that used to spend 5 minutes scrubbing now have this 90 seconds prep time. So, you know, does that then correlate in with the safety thing? If somebody breaks asepsis, actually 90 seconds to redo your hands in order to come back into a surgery is really, really quick. You don't miss out on anything. It's not detrimental to the patient. So does that actually help? And then we also had reps come back in periodically in that first year, probably, to do some support and teaching sessions. And especially when we had sort of significant new members of staff, or significant numbers of new members of staff, then to, again, making sure that everybody was taught, because again, I never wanted to get back into the, well, why are you doing it like that? Well, that's because my head nurse taught me, and that's because their head nurse taught them. You know, sometimes it's good to have that independent person to come in and do the teaching, because I still sometimes see now surgeons that are, when they're using the hand product, you know, using it on their arms, and then even in that last 30 seconds, still going a little bit further up past their wrists than I feel comfortable with. But, you know, now it's so universal and everyone uses it. It's making sure that the people that were trained, I guess, originally know that that's not right and can say that, and to make sure people do keep the same standard. So I guess it's also an ongoing review process, probably every day in a small kind of way.
Yeah, that's important as well, that it doesn't just stop once it's in place, that it does keep getting reviewed, and that people that are modelling that behaviour, or that now not change, that protocol, are doing it properly, and that they're being, you know, not like picked up on, but that they're having training. And I think you did that as well, didn't you, with the sort of consistent and regular training for everyone.
Yeah, and now, so hand hygiene from an infection control point of view is now part of everybody's mandatory training when they start in the hospital. It's almost, we do periodically do little audits and spot checks of hand hygiene processes and making sure people do know how to wash their hands properly using an alcohol-based product. So, you know, it's ongoing.
And was that there before? Just wondering. Or was that another sort of result of this change that came about?
I guess it was more of a result of increased awareness of infection control and transmission of bacteria, for example, between patients, you know. And generally, I think just everybody's increased awareness of infection control in human hospitals. Sort of the introduction of alcohol hand preparation in human hospitals means that as people walk into a ward, it's on the wall, and therefore it just becomes, again, more normal in their everyday life. And so I think it's just become more normal for everybody. So no, not a direct result of this, but more just generally from an infection control point of view.
And so far, this all sounds quite ideal. It sounds like it went beautifully. I was just wondering, like, did you have any challenges along the way, or any challenges now when you're trying to make change, and how do you overcome them?
I think we can always look back with rose-coloured spectacles, can't we? You know, at the time, I'm sure it probably wasn't as easy as I feel it is now. I think, as I say, I'm super, super lucky to work in a place where evidence-based medicine is what everyone's striving for, and therefore, you know, I can provide that this is the evidence, and therefore it was much, much easier. I can completely understand the challenges in maybe more smaller based practices where, you know, that's not the same thought process on such a daily basis. I guess people, it's change, and you sort of have to encourage change. More not problematic, but I guess when for more of a challenge, I should say, rather than a problem, with the safety checklist, you know, people get very blasé about that. I think I've had more challenges from that longer term, because people now, at the beginning, everyone was very, very good, and everybody stopped what they were doing as we did a timeout at the beginning before surgery. Nobody did anything else. Now people want to sort of get on and do stuff, and you kind of almost have to stop them making the first incision during the timeout, and that's really not what it's designed to do. So I guess that's more of a challenge. I'm possibly more vocal than others, and would ask them to stop. I understand that's not for everybody. And so we found ways around doing things. So quite often, things like, I've heard that people won't give the surgeons their blades, their scalpel blades, until after the timeout. So it's not the possibility to start the incision before we've done timeout. And I guess giving, but again, it's, to me, that's an empowerment of nurses that in that room, whilst they're running the timeout, and therefore at that point, you know, we always strive that there's no hierarchy in theatres, and that's come from the human organisations, and making sure nurses actually do feel like, actually, this is a really important part of our role and of this procedure, therefore please can everyone like stop talking and listen and interact with each other.
Yeah, definitely. It's so, so important. And it's a bit, I was just thinking when you were talking about how, you know, at the QMH where you were working, lots of people were striving towards the same thing, but actually it's different opportunities and different challenges, isn't it? Because there you've got lots more people and lots more sort of changeover and things like that, whereas in a smaller practice you've got fewer people to convince of the change or fewer people to sort of tackle and address, but there's sort of opportunities and challenges in both, aren't there? But
absolutely.
I guess, yeah, thinking about what you said before, like just stopping and thinking about what you're doing and new ways to empower nurses in order to allow these changes to occur.
Yeah, and I think nurses training has changed so significantly over the years. When I started, there was no degree in veterinary nursing, whereas now you are a you are trained to degree level to be to look at what you're doing and to be critical and evaluate basically what you're doing. And that's like really, really important, and that should be encouraged. And we want nurses to stay in practice, we want nurses to be fulfilled. We know that there's a massive shortage of nurses and vets, but in practice and just globally, it would seem, chatting to some of my American colleagues, it's the same there. And so actually, why wouldn't we want to empower nurses to feel that they're important in the practice for that patient care, that they're valued? And actually, all of these things are so positive in order to do that, rather than people becoming frustrated and disillusioned by not getting that the change or the results that they feel that they can make.
And ultimately, it is a common goal, isn't it? For, you know, we are interprofessionals, but everyone is working towards the same thing. And so there's no point in thinking that you're on your own. You know, you are part of a team, and everyone brings different things to that team. But we're working for, you know, the best thing for the patient, the best well-being. And so it should be that way, I think, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think I hate it when we sort of all feel that we're fighting each other, and I kind of want to go, but why are we fighting each other? We're all aiming for the same outcome, is that it's the positive outcome for this patient. And the more that we can all do our own little bit, and this is why nurses aren't vets, is that they can bring something different to that table than the vet can.
Yeah, and that's it. I think if people are ever, I don't know, maybe losing slight confidence or just faith in that side of things and autonomy of nurses, you've just got to look at sort of what's happening with the profession and looking at the sort of governing body with the RCVS and have a think about, you know, we've got degree nurses and we've got sort of foundation nurses and diploma nurses. And actually what has happened in the last couple of years is that there's now a pathway for everybody, and everybody, if you've done the degree or the diploma, can get onto these courses and learn about like this critical analysis and research, which may have traditionally been more focused in the degree. And the diploma, because I've taught on diploma before and we sort of discussed it and we did delve into it, but just didn't have as much time to explore it. There are those opportunities now to go and explore that further, you know, later down the line. So I think, yeah, hopefully people can gain confidence even just looking at that and going, okay, well, my profession backs me because they're trying to get me to do this. So it's a great time for nurses to start making change. Obviously you did this 10 years ago and probably started before that, but you know, now it feels like there's just a lot more sort of weight behind us all to be able to do it. I don't know if you felt like that recently or.
Yeah, I think nurses undervalue themselves for whatever reason, but actually this is the time where you are, they're all needed to do the best job that they can do. And actually therefore, you know, you want to be kept, it or the practice wants to keep you, the practice really needs you, so therefore making these niche little projects for yourself so that you've got that interest and that autonomy, exactly, autonomy is the right word, in your role, to make you that's what your practice needs, is people like that that is looking to push forward their protocols and their processes. Absolutely.
So just going back to your change that you're talking about, because it sounds like it was under review and then it has actually kind of carried on, and all of them have carried on in that review process. And so it's not like it was a change in isolation and then that's it. You know, it's continued to be audited and things like that. So I just wonder if at any point you're able to measure the success of that change, or maybe it was like a rolling thing.
That's quite a hard one, isn't it?
When yeah, you know, I'm sorry.
About measuring success, because then I guess you need to have something to compare it to before. And I guess we can look back at things like our surgical site infection rate, which we didn't ever have the problem that meant that surgical site infection rate was a really high level or an increased level, that we could track it back down to, say, a patient preparation or a hand preparation, that we could then adjust accordingly to then watch that SSI rate then drop, if that makes sense. You know, it was a development in the world of aseptic hand preparation and patient preparation that came from our human colleagues, which provided the evidence maybe that isn't exactly the same for our patients, but I guess semi can be extrapolated into our patient care. So we did definitely look at things for the patient preparation about how we could do some research into a compare type thing of products or techniques. And there have been some papers that have come out of different vet hospitals about just even nurse knowledge. So there's something, a paper that came out from Bristol team that had comparing the concentration of a soap detergent that they were using for patient prep. And actually they asked lots and lots of different nurses throughout practice and universities, like, how much of each product are you using? And it massively varied, and it didn't seem to be any standardization. So from things like that, various people have looked at, in order to sort of compare a patient prep using this technique versus a different technique, obviously kind of fits better within a research setting as opposed to a clinical hospital setting, because otherwise we potentially need to have a control group, which then if we don't believe that what we're doing is the best for that patient, is ethically slightly challenging, shall we say. So we did look at potentially comparing old with new in a resident project, but sort of lots of financial constraints of testing and that sort of thing came a bit of a challenge to that we didn't ever really manage to overcome. It would be nice to do, absolutely, but at that time it just wasn't possible. So I guess we know what our surgical site infection rate was for each procedure, but again, working in a hospital where there are so many variables, i.e. different staff members, different students scrubbing in, different kennels and different nurses looking after patients, making all of that so standard would be quite a challenge to say what actually did affect the surgical site infection rate.
I suppose that's why in the medical profession it is slightly easier with the NHS, that they have standardized protocols that are filtered out to their hospitals. So it's, you know, the way that one veterinary hospital or practice is doing something will be different to another. Yeah. And also within that practice, the way that people are doing it is different as well. So the importance of training and following protocol and making sure that everyone's doing that as well is part of it. But also measuring, like, what measures of success are we looking at? So the obvious one is the surgical site infections, but, you know, perhaps another one is it takes less time for the surgeon to prepare for surgery, which means less anaesthetic time. And there are other benefits, or I suppose disadvantages, that might come up within that change that are not directly related to the outcome that everyone thinks of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess informed consent from a human is somewhat different as well, isn't it, to our patients. I know our owners can consent, but it is slightly different outside of a research setting, at least with patients. But yeah, I agree, outcome is often, I just gave surgical site infection as an example because that's the one that people sort of always seem to look at, but you're absolutely right. I think probably with the change in the aseptic hand preparation, its compliance of actually using it is probably greater now. So, you know, everywhere in a hospital, or definitely in this hospital, there is alcohol hand prep everywhere. So that means as soon as you walk into a ward or walk out of a ward or change between patients, it's there. Therefore, it's used far more. So the overall benefit for our patients is massive by using an alcohol product that doesn't mean you have to go to a sink and use soap and water to wash your hands each time. And when everyone's super, super busy, just as they are, you know that that just doesn't happen because somebody goes, oh, can you just hold this dog for me? Or can you, and you haven't actually gone to a sink and washed your hands. Whereas having a squirt of alcohol product that's right next to you or attached to you on a belt loop thing means that it's the compliance is so much better.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that one. That's quite a good one as well. Lots of benefits.
Yes.
So on reflection, what do you think sort of worked and what didn't work, and is there anything that you'd do differently next time if you did this again? I know you sort of touched on it a little bit before, but any other things that you would change having gone through this this process and having all the experience of it and going from beginning to end?
Yeah, I definitely think, as I said to you, being a salesperson's dream, I think, yeah, making sure that, you know, you do listen to them because actually they do know their stuff. And lots of reps have got huge amounts of personal experience with the products that they're selling, which therefore means that, yeah, absolutely, they've got lots of information. But making sure that that you do your own research too. Differently, I don't know. I think there's lots of not thinking that there's only one way to do something, you know, as we've briefly mentioned as well, you know, what one hospital or practice does or what we do might not be the same or possible in another practice or another hospital because, you know, there's lots of different factors. So I really always make sure, you know, like there's not just one way of doing something, and therefore thinking about other ways or other options or slight changes to the initial thought process. Making sure, I don't think it's done differently, but I guess it was a very theatre-led project, but actually then has kind of rolled out across the hospital. So maybe some more interaction or buy-in from other areas of the hospital, because as you know, we sort of are relatively separate in some ways, but you know, making sure that you have got that into involvement of everybody.
Definitely, that all sounds great. Thank you so much for going through all of that with us today. And I guess our final question is then quite unrelated, but what is one thing that you absolutely love to do and get to do every day?
Yes, there's lots of things I like doing. I think it's easy to get bogged down with the things that you don't like doing or they're the ones you think of, but actually when you look back and think what you enjoy. So I do think I'm very honoured to work in an amazing hospital with an amazing team. I think that that's really a real positive, and I definitely feel that this last 18 months, 2 years has really shown that, you know, we talked earlier about wanting what's best for the patient. It's been hard for everybody, hasn't it? But actually, you know, that's what everyone is here to do, is to do their best for the patient, and to provide the best level of care that they possibly can. And again, absolutely, with shortages of staff and all of those sorts of things mixed in, that can make it quite challenging. But I don't think there's probably many places that are outside of maybe medicine or veterinary medicine that people could work in that actually that they feel that everybody does their very best for their patient or customer every single day. And I definitely feel that that's how veterinary practice is. So that's, I do enjoy working with so many different people.
Well, yeah, that sounds amazing. And I'm glad that you're happy, because then, yeah, that's going to mean that all your patients are happy too, because you've got to be happy in your job, haven't you? Well, thank you so much for your time today. We've really, really enjoyed talking to you.
I think it's really good. It's been nice to hear, Ali, because you have you know, all this experience, but you always think of things from everyone's perspective, and that means that everyone's encouraged and motivated. And you know, having that sort of holistic overview of things is really good, and the practical side as well, which, you know, we're working with patients on the ground floor. You know, everything needs to work, and if you make a change, then it it has to fit in with daily life, otherwise it's not gonna work and you're not gonna have that compliance. So hopefully, I really hope that you've inspired people to pursue or explore those interests that they have and really look at their practices and what they're doing, their nursing practices, to see if there's any changes that they can make for the benefit of our patients. So that's it from us. So thank you so much, Ali, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Please see our Instagram account for further information on some of the things that we've spoken about today at VNs Investigate.
And it'd be great if you could rate and review this podcast and tell your fellow vet nurse friends about it, so as many SVNs and RVNs know about this free CPD. We look forward to hearing from you all. Bye.
Bye bye.